Welcome to Making Sense, the podcast for people who want financial freedom without giving up their coffee, supported by our lovely friends at KiwiBank. I'm Frances Cook. I'm an independent financial journalist and fellow financial freedom seeker who makes money simple for you. Investing, the stock market, shares. If you're looking at my DMs and my inbox, that is the biggest thing that people want to know about. How do you work out what's going on in a company's financial statements? How much do the financials even matter? Are there warning signs you should care about? Red flags? Or what about the green flags that mean you should pile on in? And frankly, what about the gossip? Because the business world loves to gossip. But how much should you base your money decisions on it? Well, these are all things that financial journalists spend a career figuring out. So let's pick the brain of a fellow financial journalist who's been snooping around the business and share market world for even longer than I have. He's got plenty of tips to share.
Making Sense is on a mission to make money simple, and I just couldn't do that without the support of KiwiBank. It's really important to me to only work with companies that understand that mission and the difference it makes when you understand the money world. For KiwiBank, their purpose is to help Kiwi and Aotearoa be better off. So bringing you real stories of inspirational and unconventional approaches to finance is one of the ways they're making a real difference to the lives of their customers. This is Making Kiwi Better Off. This is Kiwi.
All right, welcome in, Paul Macbeth, editor of The Bottom Line. You were actually my former boss back in the old business desk days. We've both since left to do our own independent thing. So welcome. Kind of nice to turn the tables a little bit, have you on my turf.
It's a little bit intimidating. Yeah, it's just not too often that you not only have your voice being sort of broadcast over the airwaves, but your face splattered on a screen. Crikey.
Just really like to start things off with you on the back foot, just to really, you know, turn the tables.
That works. Yeah.
Look, you've been rocking around the financial world, the financial journalism world, for a while, and it's fantastic. The level of knowledge you've built up, the depth, green flags and red flags when people are looking for things, because so many people are trying to make decisions and still run their lives, look after the family, go to their day job, all that good stuff. So let's start with red flags and then we'll pivot to the much more positive green flags. Are there any tactics that companies often use to try to hide things that they're not as happy with? Places that you should be keeping an eye out for red flags.
If you can't work out how they've gone within the first three paragraphs, then you probably want to be a little skeptical of it. Like transparency, and this is a green flag as well. Like the easier it is for you to wrap your head around how they've done or what they want to do, that should give you confidence in what it is. Mm-hmm. If you look at something and you're scratching your head and you read it again and you still scratch your head,
they're burying you in jargon. Yeah. That's often a deliberate tactic. It's not that you're dumb. It's that they're doing that deliberately.
Yeah. I'm always wary of any company that when something's raising new money, if I can't see what they're spending the money on, worried about that. Like, you know, if they're saying that they're doing it to repay bank debt to give themselves more room to borrow money in the future, well, that means that the previous owners have probably saddled it with a whole bunch of debt, stripped out a bunch of cash as a dividend, and aren't just saying that this is a payday for them. If you're going to raise money, you want to be able to see what they're doing with it. It's always that transparency, and you need to understand what it is. If you can't understand it, then you've got to be a bit wary. And the converse is true as well. If you can look at something and within sort of 30 seconds, you go, I know exactly what they're doing. It is, it's a way of laughing. And even if it's a bad sort of outcome for the organization, the fact that they're front footing it and saying, this has happened, that gives you greater confidence in management and the board's ability to navigate whatever that is, because they're not trying to shy away from it. They are simply saying something happened. It's hurt us this way. These are the sorts of things that we're trying to address it. Some might work, some might not. We think they will, but if they don't, we will shift and we will tell you. Like it's treating people like they're adults, which often is. Yeah, people seem to find it hard not to sort of baby, you know, the public. which is weird. Like, we're all autonomous sort of people with sort of, you know, quite complex thought processes. We're not numpties.
Well, hopefully, most of us. I do think that's very true, though. Okay, so green flags. Are there any good signs that are hard to fake?
A board and management that is really focused on growing value tends to shine through. Like, when you look at the Mainfreights of this world, when you look at the Turners, you know, both companies with their boards, they don't necessarily tick all the boxes that, say, the Institute of Directors would want them to have at their governance, you know, not enough independent directors. And it's like, well, and, you know, you'd hear the same, you'd hear the likes of Grant Baker at Turners push back on that and say, well, we don't accept all of your ideas about that. We are focused on growth. Grant, you know, he has quite a substantial stake personally in the company. So he would say, I am aligned with the owners of this company because I am one. And we think this will grow the value of it more, rather than having an independent director here who might not necessarily sort of share our views and might be a bit more risk averse than what we as entrepreneurs might be. That entrepreneurship is hard to fake.
When we're going through things, because you've by now been figuring out what companies are up to for, as you say, yonks. And there's a lot of people who listen to this podcast who would love to pick the brains of someone like yourself in order to have a think about some of their investing decisions. So when you are trying to figure out what a company is up to, because there's what they say and there's what's actually happening behind the scenes, how often do you read through a company financials? And is that actually, is that the important part of figuring out what's going on with the company?
Definitely a key part to it. You wouldn't want to look at a company without having a good grip on what the numbers are showing you. And if the numbers aren't telling you what's going on, then there are much bigger issues at play.
What are the big ones that you look at?
I mean, the first ones you always look at are top line revenue and bottom line profit. And then the thing is, with accounting rule changes, the bottom line profit becomes a little more problematic because it's not necessarily recognizing real cash flows. We make a big song and dance about how if we were to introduce something like a capital gains tax regime in New Zealand, the administration would be insane because you've got to work out these constant movements and valuations. Well, companies do that every 6 months, if not every quarter. They have to pay tax on realized and unrealized capital gain. Like, this is something that's already built in. But flip side is they also get tax losses. You know, it's not one way traffic. It is fair value movements which feed into their income. That's still important. Like, you know, if you're looking at a property company, you still want to know whether or not the value of their property portfolio, if they had to cash up tomorrow because they ran out of cash, if they would get less. Like, these are fundamentally important things. Ultimately, cash is always king. I remember it being described to me, your income, profit and loss, that's food. Cash is oxygen. You can go a couple of, you know, you can go a couple of days without food, but oxygen, you're done if you don't have it. And again, it's different on what the sort of company is. Like, I wouldn't expect a startup, like, go back 15 years when Xero was just charging ahead. And we, collectively in the sort of domestic news industry, didn't really wrap our heads around those software as a service type companies. We didn't really understand that their whole premise was based on being able to raise a bunch of cash, spend it, and grow that top line as much as you possibly could. We would continue to look at the losses. Say with a growth company, if you're not seeing growth at that top line that's outstripping maybe the cash burn that they're going through, you might want to be a little worried. You know, very long-winded answer to it depends. There are a bunch of different metrics relative to what you're looking at, like, and all of them do matter. What do I expect out of this company? Like, if I'm looking at, say, Mainfreight, just because it's top of mind in my head, like, how is their earnings growth going? Where are they expanding their markets? Are they maintaining that dividend? Are they thinking about buying something? Like, these are all questions that you're looking at when you dive into their accounts, which those are going to be out later this month. Each of these companies has a bunch of different metrics that are important in their own right. You know, when you're looking at them, you do want to have a, you know, starting out, get a grip on where all those things are.
So you would be assessing a company differently based on like, what are their goals as a company? First of all, you know, how big are they? Are they a startup? Are they just trying to grow? Or are they bigger, more established? We have more expectation of they're not trying to grow like mad. They should have more cash on hand. So you're trying to take into account that context of the company for starters. And then you're looking at things like the cash flow. Then after that, things like the profit and loss.
Oh, yeah. Because the way that I was always taught to write was that we were writing for the retail shareholder, the person who at the time had a, you know, that inherited maybe 1,000 telecom shares. How are they meant to make head nor tail out of the annual report?
Mm.
That then goes back to intention. Who am I thinking about here? What the company's looking at in terms of its own internal metrics is very different from what the owners, the shareholders, will be wanting out of it. Yeah. Like if you're looking at, say, a Fletcher building, 15, 20 years ago, you would have been wanting growth. You would have wanted been reliable dividends. You would have expected them to continue to deliver on what they were doing. Now you're looking at that and you're hoping that they can turn things around. The idea of what the owners want out of that should be directing what you're looking at. This is the wonderful thing about these companies is that, you know, you look at them in isolation because that's what they do, but you also see how they affect each other. Like I had that realization, must have been, maybe 10 years ago, that you do these things for a while and then you start seeing the big spidery web that is the economy. And when you're looking at it from bottom up, you start recognizing, oh, geez, no, these things are related. Like that's just all quite astonishing type things.
Where do you look to get this sort of information? Because there's shareholder meetings, of course, if people have the time to turn up to those. There's also, you know, all sorts of different documents that are released through the year. Where are you looking? What do you think are the most important places to get information, given how time poor most people are?
I mean, if I was starting out looking at something, I'd want to read the annual report. Depending on how long ago that investment had sort of gone to the public and asked them for, you know, out with the begging bowl, I'd want to look at their offer document. Those offer documents, they give you great histories of the companies and what they're trying to achieve. And as a starting point, it's a really good way to wrap your head around what is this organization actually trying to do? Look, I was just looking at one the other day for company Marsden Maritime Holdings, which owns half of Northport up in Northland. They're great reminders of what they are trying to achieve. It's not just they're trying to clip the ticket on freight volumes in and out of Whangarei. It's actually part of a broader strategic thing to unlock value around Northland. And it's massively reliant on Kiwi Rail coming to the party and getting a rail link up to Marsden Point, which is where the port is, plus the four-lane highway back and forth. So if you get those links going up there, then you can get this giant, you can have this expansion of this port, and then you can have do the business park outside that, commercial, you know, warehousing and other operations that might want to be near an export-import port. And then you can build housing out that. Like you look at the way that Tainui did it down with the Ruakura inland port, which is just astonishing in Hamilton. I remember going down there for the turning of a sod, how many years ago it was, and they sort of explained out the 50 years that they had mapped out in turning this inland hub in Hamilton, and then you'd have these industrial properties around it, and then after that, you'd build all of this residential housing. You go, right, yes, multi-decade investment. You know, in the case of Tainui, they can do it in-house. And when you're thinking about, say, Marsden Maritime up in Whangarei, maybe being a publicly listed company is not the right vehicle for that. And you know, Port of Tauranga is involved in the consortium as well, so there's an element there. But maybe it does need to get away from the disclosure requirements and costs that come with that and narrowing down its ability to raise money from other sources. So getting back to, you know, it's easy to get onto an aside. These are the sorts of stories that those sorts of reports tell. And that's how you really understand it. And so from there, then you'd want to, you know, annual reports give you a great update on how things are tracking. Like they are dense and they need to be. Like these are big organizations. But in terms of things that are readable, you want to look at maybe some of those research reports. Like there are very, very smart people working in those investment houses like the Jardins of this world, the Craigs Investment Partners. And some of it is very dry, yes, but they can help you understand what it is that you're trying to invest in. And that's ultimately the main thing. Like, you know, if you don't understand what you want to put your money into, don't. Like it's just bananas. Like if you can look at something, and if you can't work out, and it might take a bit of time, but if you can't work out how they make money, then maybe they're not. You don't immediately just go, I'm too stupid, but everyone else is doing this. It's like, this just doesn't make sense. I mean, this is what happened in the GFC, the magic sort of engineering that they came up with that.
If it feels like money is just appearing out of thin air and everyone's making money and so I should get in because they are, even if I don't understand what's going on, no, that's a red flag. That's a red flag.
Well, or at least understand what that is. Like I was reading Sir James, who was used to be the boss of Jarden. He's taken over as sort of the chair of the company while Chris steps back. James might have been late last year or early this year, stepped in and filled in for one of Chris's weekly columns. So James sort of looked at Bitcoin at the time. I think it was just over $100,000 US. And he ran through the argument about what Bitcoin is as an investment. And some people sort of look at it as though it's something to hedge against rising prices in the same way that gold does, that it holds a natural and tangible value. Well, I think James pointed out that, well, you've already got gold to do that. And Bitcoin only has 10, 15 years of history behind it. It doesn't necessarily have the same practical applications that a precious metal might have. So it's hard to sort of look at it as though it's a proper long-term investment because it doesn't have that centuries of history there. But you can't deny that in terms of a speculative trading asset where that price fluctuates back and forward, that's what it's there to do.
I know it's funny, the Bitcoin versus gold comparisons, because everyone often leaves out of that conversation that gold actually has so many industrial uses as well. It does have practical purposes that are part of what gives it that value. So it's funny that it's not just that we've all decided that gold is valuable. But yeah, really good points on that. Look, there was something you mentioned there about when we were talking about if you don't understand things and not buying in. And that triggered a bit of a thought to me, because we often talk about, as soon as you know new information about a company, that is often already baked into the price. So there's this talk of, and I don't buy this idea that the market is this all-knowing, all-wonderful thing that perfectly prices things, but it is pretty efficient. It is pretty good at, there's a bunch of people who want to buy and sell things. Information comes out. It is some very smart people's jobs to be paying close attention and reacting instantly. Bad news comes out, quick sell, get rid of it. Good news comes out, quick buy it more, get it. And for the average person who is trying to maybe get ahead of that and saying, oh, I think this is undervalued and I'm going to buy it more while it's cheap and then I get more money later on. That's really hard to do, because when we talk about something being baked into the price, it's that all of these very smart people are watching constantly. It's literally their job, and reacting within seconds, that it is very, very hard for the average person who even hears about it at the end of the day, never mind maybe you've had a busy week and you read the report at the end of the week or the end of the month. It's been decades in market land since then. So how true is it, do you think, about things already being in the price? And does the average punter have a shot against big investing funds reacting in those milliseconds sometimes?
Part of this comes down to flow of money, right? There are active money managers out there, people who think that they can beat the market. And they do that based on the idea that these giant exchange traded funds, these passive things that have to track the index and, you know, every time there's a new reweighting, they have to tweak their portfolio and buy more of this and sell some of that. That weight of money drives up prices. Conversely, it also pushes prices down faster as well. So you get these big movements, and you've got active money managers out there who will look at things like that and think, no, these sort of passive flows are mispricing stuff. And that's where they try and make their money, in identifying where that weight of money might have got things wrong. And this is one of the big problems of New Zealand's domestic market, and it's something that everyone is aware of, but no one has worked out how to achieve it. Like, they talk about liquidity, and that's just the flow of money, like back and forward. Because the idea about an efficient price is that you have enough people out there bidding on something that the price will narrow down to what someone's willing to sell for and someone's willing to pay.
Mm.
The more sell orders and the more buy orders that you've got out there should give you a pretty good indication of where that fair price is. If you've got these giant funds coming in that are either coming out and dumping everything or coming out and buying everything, that influences that.
And they're doing that with millions of dollars sometimes.
Yeah, billions. But there's always that mispricing there. And it depends on your time frame, right? So let's say, and just thinking about, Warren Buffett finishing up, flagging his exit from Berkshire Hathaway. He didn't make his money by taking short bets on things. He made long-term investments that didn't really play out until the tail end of his career. The compounding over time caused that massive explosion in the value of Berkshire Hathaway. But he sort of had very clear ideas on what he thought about capital allocation, on how some companies needed to spend their money and invest it back in themselves. And he didn't clip the ticket with a management fee on top of that sort of thing. He wanted these companies to run their businesses well. So then ultimately over time, that value would accrue. Now, if you're thinking about equity, like if you're going to be investing in stock markets, ideally, as an investment, you're taking this as a long term, and a long term is not 5-year nonsense that you see in like these offer documents. Long term equity holding is 20 plus. This is the lifespan of a company. It should grow over a period of time. Now, you might want to reassess that. Things will change over time, but it's not a flash in the pan. If you want it to be a flash in the pan, that's trading. That's not quite invested. You're looking for a short-term gain over a short period of time. And you're not necessarily trying to beat the market over time. You're just looking for an opportunity. Like it was a deal. Like I had to grab it type thing. Or, price was just too high and just had to sell. And that's a perfectly rational thing to do, but that's not what your whole long-term investment time frame is. That's just being opportunistic. And some people can make a great living out of it. Some people can't. But that sort of all goes back to that idea that there are inherently undervalued things out there that regular people can identify and take advantage of. Conversely, they will overpay for a whole bunch of things. One of the ways that sort of finance world thinks about value in companies is the price to earnings multiple. Basically, what you're paying and how many years it'll take for that company to generate enough profits to cover what you've earned. That's not necessarily, you're not getting that all cash in hand because they'll redeploy some of that back into their company. And it's at some stages, it's 20, 25 times sort of things for logistics. And you're just thinking about that. So I'm willing to wait for 20 to 25 years before my investment has sort of generated enough profit covering that. That's what we're paying now. 10, 15 years ago, it was much skinnier. And these things change over time. Mm. Like we get stuck in these, it's that sort of present bias, right? you see the thing that is right in front of you and you think it's always going to be like that. When people are looking at sub 5% mortgage rates, it's like, New Zealand's never had sub 5% mortgage rates for long periods of time. This is, do not base your 30-year sort of future on this thing not going above 8% at some point, which it will.
Yeah.
But I've digressed somewhat. Gosh, it's like often people you see get spooked when a company goes public and they sell their shares for the first time I mean, I know we haven't had one in New Zealand for a while, and in theory, should get a spike in the price.
Mm-hmm.
In theory, that's about the time that all of those big money types, the institutional investors, will sell down to take advantage of that spike, and then they'll buy back in when the price goes down below that. Well, if you as a retail investor are buying into an IPO, an initial public offering is what they called it, you know, you're not buying it for that sort of 4-week noise. Or if you are, you need to, you know, you need to be really aware of that, that this is what you're buying it for. It's, you know, you're buying into it because you believe this company's actually got an opportunity to either, you know, grab some big market share over the next 20, 25 years, and that will substantially increase the size of your investment and contribute to your wealth over time. Or you believe that it will spit out a nice amount of cash because it's a mature business, it's well run, the management team know what it's doing, and they're very good at keeping their investors with a nice, tasty little dividend every every 6 months or so, which relative to the bank, the term deposits that you might get on offer for the bank are more attractive. Plus, there's the potential for capital appreciation. But you're thinking about these things. And so, you know, going back to, I think, you know, something I said earlier, intention. It's about the intention out there. And, you know, if you want to overpay for something because you think that even if the market might have it wrong now, but it's still on an upward trajectory, then there's nothing wrong with that.
Just have something behind it, right? That's guiding it.
Yeah.
Just have something there.
You're not buying something for 6 months. Or if you are, then, you know, be very clear on why you're buying it for 6 months.
Yeah, exactly.
Life looks different for everyone. Maybe you're buying your first home, growing your whānau, dreaming of travel, or simply trying to stay on top of things. KiwiBank has the tools to help you manage your money your way. Find out more at kiwibank.co.nz. This is making Kiwi better off. This is Kiwi.
Well, I mean, it's funny, isn't it? Because I often see around the traps this idea of don't pay attention to the news, just keep investing, stay the course. And I understand where that advice comes from. I think there's a grain of truth in it, but it's massively oversimplified at this point because everyone says it and they say it with such certainty. And it's not quite true, I think, in terms of, I think the news does a really good job of breaking down sort of the big movements and taking things like you've said, the annual reports can be quite dense, but it is literally a journalist's job to read through that and make it a bit simpler and give you the top line of that. Where I think people come in on that is they're saying, don't get emotional based on it. Don't freak out based on it. So my personal strategy is, yeah, I keep an eye on the news. Yeah, I keep an eye on the headlines. Do I panic? Do I think because this one thing has happened, everything is cratering? Not so much. And once you've been paying attention for a little while, it's easier not to get emotional. It's easier not to freak out about this stuff. But the other part about why I actually do think you should pay attention to the news on this stuff is because journalists get gossip and they get scuttlebutt. And, you know, what we've talked about here in terms of the numbers are one thing, the numbers are great, and you can go and look at all these reports and figure it out. But I also think that sometimes you hear little sort of sniffs of things around the place, and that can influence you past the numbers, and that can make you interested in something that you maybe wouldn't be, or uninterested in something that you were interested in before. So what about yourself? The gossip, the scuttlebutt, the chat around the social side, how important is that for figuring out which companies are actually performing well and which ones aren't?
They will ultimately feed into it. Like if you think about where there might be a bad culture, where there's a high staff turnover because people are unhappy, those sorts of things are that's the gossip that you'll end up hearing. And if it's people aren't happy, that's obviously, that's normally a big red flag that the management team isn't doing, you know, it doesn't have its sort of, its settings right to keep its most valuable resources in-house. And that probably also tells you that the board isn't paying enough attention to what's going on there. Like these are really important things. And if the board's not paying enough attention to how the resources within this organization are being sort of directed, or if that retention is working, there are problems there. Like that's like a board, a board of directors acts on behalf of the owners of the company, being the shareholders. Its number one job is basically around capital allocation. Like it's meant to sort of decide how money gets spent, how much money gets put back to shareholders, how much gets reinvested. It signs off on big ticket items. It tells the management team to come up with a couple of big blue sky strategies on where they think things should be going, and goes, yeah, let's go with that one. If they've got it wrong, then that will ultimately lead to a decline in value. You might not get a dividend payment if that's the sort of organization that it is. So that gossip, while not necessarily feeding directly into things, those are the things that give you a good indication as to whether or not a company is, if there are issues there, or conversely, if it's going great. If you constantly hear about how people love working at a place, if, again, just because I've got Main Freight on my mind, Main Freight has a reputation for being a very good employer. It has a reputation for having great retention. It has a reputation for having a board and management team that are aligned not only with the shareholders, but that keep their staff on board. Their profit share for each individual office is impressive. If they're within 90% of the previous year's profit, that unit will get a profit share element. So you don't even need to have that constant growth type thing. That's just built into part of the business's DNA. And, that goes back to, founder Bruce Plested's idea of building a 100-year company. It wasn't a flash in the pan type thing. And this has turned into a global logistics company. It's not one of the mega giants, but in New Zealand terms, this thing is huge. It has a global footprint. It is globally a niche operator, but it does it well. So those are the sorts of things when you hear those sorts of things get reaffirmed over and over again by people in the know, by people who aren't in the know, it just builds up this idea that, okay, no, that's not something that you need to pay too much attention to for now, because they've got it under wraps. In fact, you're probably going to have faith that they will ride through the regular ups and downs of market land, because they're focused on a long-term thing. So might not necessarily be the most fun for a day trader, but over time, that's why long-term investors love that sort of thing. When big stuff comes out, gossip hits, it matters.
Yeah, 100%. Look, on a personal level as well, because I know people are always interested in this. I get plenty of messages about it myself. So do you invest, and has your career reporting on these companies changed anything about your personal investing strategy?
I didn't invest up until I left Business Desk full time, which was at the start of last year.
I was just going to say, that's so fresh.
Yeah, I'd never, because I'd sort of subscribed to the idea that I was, too close to these things. You don't want to put yourself in a situation where you're trying to defend this, that, or the next thing. Over time, I've kind of shifted on that. I tend to think, if you're open and you disclose everything very clearly, that people aren't stupid. And I've been around this long enough to realize that, yes, I have my own internal biases, but the news trumps that. A good story is a good story, even if it might, it might not necessarily be in my own personal interest. And when I think about if I think about through the, particularly the 2010s, where you couldn't go a day without the Herald telling you about how it was never the best time in the world to buy a house, you had a whole cohort of journos out there who would never disclose whether or not they were renting or residential property owners or residential property investors. So it made me rethink about that. So long story short, also I had, I had a substantial amount of cash from our sale to NZME. I was one of the major shareholders, so I walked away astonishingly good.
I know. I joined right after that, and it was so annoying because in my initial conversations I'd be like, there's still a possibility to buy in as shareholder, and then no, missed it. damn it. So you did all right then.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Numis, I did astonishingly good. So I was like a 10% shareholder early on. We had a bit of a payday when Brian Gaynor came in.
And I'm going to super quickly, for anyone who's not sort of deep in the media world, of course, Business Desk was independent. The reporters who came on board earlier did have things like the possibility to become part owner, to have shares in it, and then was bought by NZME, became part of the Herald and Newstalk ZB and all that other good stuff, which meant that all of the original people who were on board got a nice little payday, which is you. Not me, unfortunately. I joined too slow.
Yes, and it was a good payday. It was a good payday. I had an astonishing return on investment.
Nice. I'm happy for you, sad for me.
So, but it had just been sitting there for a couple of years. I think I just had it in a current account.
Oh my God, Paul.
I know, ridiculous, eh? I did the same thing with my KiwiSaver. It took me up until 2014, so I'd probably been on KiwiSaver for about 5 years before I made an active choice to get out of the Tower default fund.
Oh my God. This is, you know, the saying about the cobblers always have the worst shoes, that they fix everyone else's shoes and not their own. This is you right now.
Oh yeah, 100%. Yeah, and only reason I did, because I'd been meaning to shift it into Milford for a long time. And it was the prospect of Fisher Funds, who I didn't like their fee structure. That was the thing that got me to go, nope, I am actually making that choice. So the start of last year, I, you know, had a bunch of cash and I just went, okay, I'll put some into a couple of Milford funds. Always had a huge amount of respect for Matt Goodson at Salt Funds Management. So a bit of money into one of his funds and a handful of stocks that I thought were just on an ETF, S&P, the NZX 50 ETF, and a handful of stocks that I thought were largely undervalued. Some of that came from just covering it over the years.
Yeah.
I had this thought last night. I was writing about Main Freight last night and I was looking at it and the share price had come back because it's taken an absolute hammering at the start of the year. And I was thinking, oh, geez, this is too cheap. Like I'd got a bit of money out of, I have some shares of Tower, which had a capital return recently. And that's just sitting in the Sharesies account at the moment. I was saying, I should buy some Main Freight shares. I can't do that now because I am writing a story that will be published tomorrow morning and that is a terrible, terrible conflict. So maybe give it a week or so. And at the current price, I mean, in my mind, when I sort of look at it, I go, as a long-term hold, that I would personally have confidence that it would sort of appreciate over time. I'm joined up with the New Zealand Shareholders Association. I have always thought that they do excellent advocacy work. I would tend to think that if someone's going to be investing in New Zealand shares, they should probably be a part of that. I mean, it's I can't remember how much it was for the annual membership, but the work that they do and the facilities that they have as well, they're reporting on companies, covering annual meetings, massively valuable. And you look at that and you just go, this is an organization that, if you were going to be interested in investing in New Zealand, you should pony up for. Like, you know, there's that classic sort of thing. New Zealanders know the price of everything and the value of nothing. Like, you know, actually just fork over cash. Like, there are things that are worth it. And don't try and get your employer to expense it. And don't expect the taxpayer to cover it through the government. Like, value these things in your life. And be willing to pour your money into it, unless it's all bound up in the mortgage, in which case, fair enough. Yeah. But,
as is the case for many, many people. Hey, look, we're nearly out of time and I want to talk about what you've mentioned there in terms of your new venture, because it's fascinating to me watching people go out and do the independent thing, as both you and I have. I have never subscribed to the idea that journalism is dying, but the idea that it might change form, 100%. And I think this is part of it, right? So many more independent voices coming out and doing their own thing. I think that might be the future, sort of boutique journalism, if you will. So you have recently launched The Bottom Line. I love it. It has been a really interesting move from you. So tell me more about it, what you hope people get from it, and why you felt like it was needed.
It's basically a subscription site. And the audience that I think isn't really being looked after by the likes of, you know, Business Desk or the National Business Review, the Herald, is very much that retail investor. Like we got 700,000 people with Sharesies accounts now. And yeah, there's going to be a lot of ones that is just people sign up and then do nothing with. And there are others who are just going to, you know, I set it up, you know, they might have set it up to do an auto payment of $5 a week going into an S&P 500 index fund. But there are others who will be slightly more engaged. And like that's a big audience with a shared interest that, if I think about the way that business news is done in New Zealand at the moment, and I did it for, you know, 15, 16 years, we write for the big end of town. You're writing for the people in your sort of commercial bay in Auckland who are deeply involved in the companies. And that's important. They need to be catered for because, you know, they employ thousands of people. They need to understand those sorts of things. But for the tens of thousands of people who own these companies, where are they in this equation? Like, you know, because they've got different incentives. Like, it can be very sad when a company is laying off hundreds of people. But if you're an owner of that company and they've been really sloppy with their spending over the years, you will probably be, as a shareholder, happy with their cutting back on spending because, you know, it's a slightly more rational approach. You can't just keep hiring people for no reason unless it's going to add value to the company. So the idea was to cater for them in a way that, you know, I've sort of built up a bit of institutional experience over the years. And it's a very much a learning one. Like I like to think of it as sort of being a personal finance with a Bloomberg lens. Slightly pointier than perhaps some of the personal finance columns out there, which you know, very helpful, very useful, but I mean it's a little bit repetitive and you know a little too consumery, I think, in the broader sort of budgeting sense. So I think I just thought that there was that space for people who are on a Sharesies account who have got a Tiger Broking platform. On any number of sort of platforms out there, jumping onto Queen Street Bets and sort of being keyboard warriors, or if they're a boomer or a Gen Xer on ShareTrader and having their reckons on this company's PE multiple, like where can they go to read something slightly interesting? And I mean, I do have a newsletter that caters to sort of that gossipy, chatty type deal making thing that you typically read in the Australian Financial Review Street Court Talk column. So it's, you know, throwing a few things out there because like you, I am a firm believer in that the media is shifting in New Zealand. I tend to think of it, and I've been waiting for it for a while, the fragmentation of it. Like we look at our majors and think that they've been there forever, but they haven't. Like, you know, before Sinead owned stuff, you know, it was Fairfax, and Fairfax bought it off Rupert Murdoch's INL, and INL spent decades buying newspapers up across the country. Yeah, Wilson and Horton was just the Herald before it turned into APN, before it turned into NZME. The radio network, ZB, that was part of the government-owned sort of commercial radio stations way, way back before it was spun out. Like, these entities and organizations, like everything else, are dynamic. They don't have a right to just continue forever. And yeah, that's why they're struggling. You're seeing the shift, you're seeing the change, and you kind of expect that over time. Like Duncan Grieve over at the spinoff has sort of just shown us such an amazing success story. It's a hard slog for him, but 10 years he's built that. I'm hiring 30 people in a wonderful little business. You know, the guys at Newsroom, Tim and Mark, done a stellar job with transforming that from what was a press release service that when it was set up 1,000 years ago. You want more dynamism. You want things to be more dynamic in the industry. And if I'm a part of that, that'll be a great and glorious thing. If I'm not, you know, that is part of the whole sort of learning about how it all is. And you want to see more of these sorts of things. So that's kind of where I'm pushing out with that.
It's exciting. I love seeing it for you. All right. Well, if people want some of that, where do they sign up to get all your good stuff?
TheBottomLion.co.nz. You can either get a 10 trip, which is $10 for 10 stories if you want a bit of a taster. Otherwise, it's a $52 for an annual includes GST because I hate subscriptions that exclude it. It just makes me so angry. So basically $1 a week for just general access, or $2 a week to get the newsletter on top of that.
Perfect. Well, thank you so much for coming on and breaking that down for us. Paul Macbeth, editor of The Bottom Line. We are also thinking of doing a live so that you can send him your questions and pick his brain. If you heard some of what he was saying about what you need to look at for the numbers, or what you can look at for the gossip and the scuttlebutt and where to find that, and you're thinking, love it, want to know more, drop those questions into either the comments here. If you're watching on YouTube, you can send it to me on social media, and we're thinking we'll do a live. So keep an eye out for that, and we will hopefully answer any more questions that you have. Until next time, of course, if this episode was helpful to you, then don't forget to hit subscribe to Making Sense. Send it to a friend as well, so that we can all stay up to date with the latest tips and tricks for our money. And until next time, have a great day. Just a note before you go, this podcast can only give you general information about how things work in most cases. It's not individual financial advice. We're all different, so some of this might not apply to your specific situation. Take what works for you, ignore the rest. If you're after individual financial advice, a financial advisor is always the best bet.